Winston Groom is the author of 21 books, three of which have been made into movies, and one of which has become an American classic, Forrest Gump. And Winston joins me today from Point Clear, Alabama. Welcome to the show, Winston.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot I want to cover today, but let's get to Forrest Gump first. I mean, that was such a landmark experience for all Americans. I was wondering how the idea came to you.
Well, it's sort of been a roundabout way. I was living in New York then. That was, what, 1986, I guess? Or maybe it was earlier than that, 85. And I was coming home to see my father, who was getting older, and my mother had passed away, and he was an old lawyer in Mobile, Alabama. And I'd come home in the winters to get out of the winters in New York and spend a month or so. And so on one of these occasions, I took him to lunch, and he began to reminisce about growing up in Mobile, Alabama. He was born in 1906, if that gives you an idea.
Sure.
And he reminisced that there was a young man in his neighborhood who was then called retarded, and the kids in the neighborhood would tease him and throw sticks at him and so forth. And so one day this young man's mother bought a piano and brought it into the house. And within a couple of days, his beautiful music came wafting out through the windows. And I remembered then that 60 Minutes had recently done a story on what they call the idiot savant syndrome, where you got a person who can barely tie their own shoelaces, but they can do complicated mathematical and musical things. And so I thought that evening, I'm going to sit down and make some notes on this. Maybe I can use it for a scene somewhere in a book. And late that night, I had done the first chapter of Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
It was weird.
Yeah. So you started writing it. Was it an easy write? Was it something that you had to really struggle
easiest
with?
Easiest thing I ever did.
It was easiest.
Easiest thing I ever did.
Yeah.
It literally wrote itself. I never had that happen before, and I haven't had it happen since. I remember that Joe Heller told me one time that Catch-22 did that. I'm not sure I believed him, but this one was very strange, and it was just the easiest thing. I didn't have a net. I didn't have any kind of notes, outline. I think it comes from what I call that lizard brain.
Yeah.
Which is down at the base of our neck.
Yeah.
And it goes right up through the regular brain onto the 10 fingers, onto the keys.
Yeah. So you woke up in the morning and you said, what's going to happen with Forrest today? Was that kind of the idea?
Yeah. I just say, well, yeah, what are we going to do with him today? I would have a little fun with it. And I mean, the book is basically a farce.
Yeah.
There's some down moments in it, but it was a lot of fun. And I couldn't get over the fact that it was just sort of, it was carrying me along with it.
It's a beautiful thing.
I was the instrument.
Right. You hear that about, you know, let's say Mozart or one of these giants of music and other areas where, you know, they just, it just comes out of them. You know, it's like, they're almost like vessels to get it on the page more than they are the creators themselves.
Yeah. Sometimes that'll happen. And I don't know, it hadn't happened since. So I have no reason to suspect it will, but it'd be nice.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that you mentioned was that you had met Gregory Peck, I guess after the movie had come out, and he said to you that the character, Forrest Gump, was one of the few national heroes we have had in this day and age. He said, America's produced a lot of, well, you say America's produced a lot of anti-heroes, but we don't have heroes anymore. The only thing Peck said is that Forrest Gump is an idiot, you know, and so in a sense, he's kind of an anti-hero himself. Why do you think Americans are so attracted to the anti-hero?
Oh, I think it's a phase we're going through. There are a lot of fiction in, say, the last 30 or 40 years has dwelled on the anti-hero. And I think that, I don't know we'll ever come out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Fiction today is very strange to me. It's written by people who seem to be self-absorbed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's personal. There's a lot of message stuff out there. And I've always said, in my books, you don't look for a message. You want a message, call Western Union or Twitter or something.
Yeah,
you know, but
I just
try to be an entertainer and tell tales. But yeah, that was an interesting observation by Gregory Peck.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you talk about being an entertainer. You've had a number of movies. You had three books that were made into movies: Forrest Gump, As Summers Die with Jamie Lee Curtis, Betty Davis, and Scott Glenn, and then Firebirds with Nicolas Cage and Tommy Lee Jones.
What was that? I don't know that book. I didn't write that book.
Oh, really? That was on the material. So was it two books? What was that?
Well, there was actually three, but the third one didn't count because they failed to get my permission to make the movie, and I had to file a big lawsuit.
I didn't know that.
It was horrible. It was like having a rocket issue for 2 years.
How did it end up?
I won.
Oh, you won.
They do that. They'll try to break you.
I see.
These big entertainment companies. They stonewall you, and they don't notice you're running up huge legal bills. And finally, when they realize there's nowhere to hide, they cave in.
Hmm.
But that's a very unpleasant thing. But anyway, no, the movies I have made, I think people have been very conscientious about doing them.
Well, you told a story about, with Forrest Gump, you told the story about how they wanted to go to the University of Alabama, and they had asked you if you knew anybody there and you knew the president. Why don't you tell that story real quick?
Well, they wanted to film up there, and so I said, well, send me a script. And they did. The latest script. Now, I'd written the first couple of scripts, and they get three or four other people in between. And I looked at this script, and it had a number of historical inaccuracies in it that did not reflect well on the university. And so I told that to this producer, and he said, oh, don't worry about that. He said, universities like to have big movie studios making shows about them. It's a good publicity. And he said, we're Paramount Pictures. And I said, well, that's nice, but you may not know this, but the University of Alabama is bigger than Paramount Pictures. And if I send this script on like it is, I think they're going to be distressed. And so I'll go ahead and send it. So I sent it on, and a couple of weeks later, I got a phone call. This guy, and he says, well, we don't understand this at all. He said, we not only got a letter from the university, he said, we can't film there. We got a letter from their lawyers saying we can't even use the name of the University of Alabama.
So,
the trademark Crimson Tide and all this thing.
Right.
But, well, what it did was it got those changes made. That was the main thing.
Yeah. I guess in Alabama, the University of Alabama is bigger than everything, right? It's more important than
pretty
everything.
Pretty big.
Yeah, pretty big. Hey, so your first book was published in 1978. It was called Better Times Than These. It was at the end of the Vietnam War, and I think it kind of reflected your experience. How did you get your first book published? I mean, you had never really written anything, as far as I know. How did you actually get it published?
Well, I've been a journalist for 10 years in Washington, and a friend of mine from the Washington Post had left his job, and he was going to meet his father up in somewhere called the Hamptons, which I didn't know what that was. And turned out his father was Irwin Shaw, who was the guy that wrote Rich Man, Poor Man, and The Young Lions, and so forth. And so anyway, his daddy had this big, beautiful home there on the Georgia Pond, there in Bridgehampton and Waynescott. And it was two houses. So we stayed together that summer, and I made some friends up there. I mean, practically every major writer in America was up there then.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody from James Jones to Kurt Vonnegut, George Plimpton, Norman Mailer, everybody's out there.
Amazing.
And Capote was there. I forget who all some of these people were. But anyway, they're all very congenial. And one of the people who was there was Willie Morris, who had not too long before that been the boy wonder editor of Harper's Magazine. And he asked to read I had about 100 pages done, and he asked to read it. And he pronounced it, he liked it. And he said, I'm going to send it along to an agent friend of mine. And he did. And that agent accepted that in an outline, and then within a week he had it sold to Simon & Schuster.
Oh, amazing. Boy, that must have been very exciting.
And that was a stroke of luck. But anyway, sort of got me off and running. It was pretty well received, and so I never looked back. That's been almost like 40 years now.
Now, you know, times were different back then. Everyone can be a writer these days with self-publishing. What advice can you offer would-be writers who are trying to break through in the business and don't have the luck that you have to have a friend in the Hamptons and something like that? How do you break in today?
Make friends in the Hamptons. No, wouldn't do any good these days because the only people out there now is hedge fund people.
Yeah.
But now finding an agent is very important. You just got to keep at it. I mean, there's no solution. I get asked this question all the time, and I say, what you do, you put your ass in a chair, your fingers on the keys, and see what happens. And don't be discouraged the first time it doesn't.
Yeah.
Nothing comes of it.
Yeah.
If you really want to do it, you know, try and you know, see what happens. And but you're right. Now there's so many different books. There are hundreds of thousands of these things actually published every year.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like having 100,000 brands of toothpaste.
Right.
I don't know how anybody knows what to buy.
How do you break through? Yeah, yeah. You know, you had mentioned that you had a lot of editors in your life, and one in particular you mentioned that was just so wonderful. You said, but today most editors are not editors anymore. They're book buyers. What does that mean?
Well, they're hired on the basis of their ability to acquire valuable manuscripts.
Oh.
They don't do things like, was it Maxwell Perkins, some of these old-time editors, and I've had a few like that, who actually could shape copy. They could really help you,
yeah,
especially when you're young, but you're just starting out, because writing a novel, a big novel, is a lot different from writing a newspaper story. I can tell you that for sure.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, they see things that you don't see. They've been doing it for a long time and everything. It'll just, it just pass along and say, well, it looks good. I'm going to pass along to the copy editor, who just correct, basically the copy editor just corrects mistakes and puts little 1Ms in. But more and more the publishers are going to these people because they are the ones that represent, you know, the income for the publisher. Mm-hmm. They can go out and find a writer who's either unknown or who's already known and dissatisfied and bring him into the house.
Gotcha. My guest is Winston Groom. He is, of course, the author of the American classic Forrest Gump. It's also written 21 books, 13 of which are nonfiction. The rest are fiction. And I want to ask you, Winston, to talk about your most current book. By the way, to hear this segment again and to find out more about Winston, don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and of course, I'm Steve Pomerantz. Winston, so tell us about this new book. It's called El Paso.
Well, it started out about 20 years ago as a sort of collection of stories. And a friend of mine would tell me over about his family. He was a wealthy, very wealthy family from New York. It was a Morgan family. And they had a huge piece of land in northern Mexico, I think well over a million acres, and hundreds of thousands of cows and so forth. And a lot of wealthy Americans had places down there then because the Mexican government really couldn't handle it. They didn't have any money for infrastructure down there, so they sold the land to the Americans. And this was in 1916, which is coincidentally 100 years to the year.
Yeah.
This is 2016.
Good point. That's right. Mm-hmm.
That was one of the years of the Pancho Villa Revolution. He was one of the revolutionaries. There was a whole bunch of them.
Mm-hmm.
But he was one, the main one in northern Mexico, and
he
had basically left these Americans alone, except that in 1916, Woodrow Wilson recognized his arch enemy, General Carranza, as being the legitimate ruler of Mexico, and he forbade Villa from going to El Paso, where he got his arms and his munitions and his supplies for his army. So Villa began to attack the Americans. He went on to this ranch in the state of Chihuahua that my friend's family had, and he strung up the manager of the ranch and sabered him to death.
Mm-hmm.
And then he kidnapped his children. And this was just one of a number of stories that my friend told me. And I was thinking, all these years, you know, there's just something that compels me to write about this. But a collection of stories like that is not a novel. It's really just a collection of tales. And so I sat down a couple of years ago, and said, all right, I'm going to really get after this, man, and see if I can invent some interesting characters and throw them in there and grab a few historical characters and fling them in there, too,
right,
and see what sticks. And some of the historical characters, I just intended to have them as cameos, but they wound up being so interesting, I left them in there as actors.
Well, I know you added the movie star Tom Mix and General Pershing and the then Lieutenant Patton, who later, of course, became General Patton. And then the satirist Ambrose Bierce, who I think most of us don't really know about him. And if I may, I found a couple of quotes, and I think this kind of maybe explains his character. You know, he said about love, "Love is a temporary insanity curable by marriage." And he said about the future, which I really related to, "The future is that period of time in which our affairs prosper, our friends are true, and our happiness is assured." So he was kind of character, right?
He was. Well, those were quotes from something he wrote called The Devil's Dictionary, where he defined words.
Okay.
And he was a very well-known of his day, well-known journalist. He'd been an officer, a Union officer in the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And he did, in fact, go to Mexico, I believe, 1913 or 14, and he vanished down there. And I don't know what happened to him in the book. It all happened to him, but what happens to him in the book, I invented and I own it. And that's what happened to him, as far as I'm concerned. I won't give it away, but his name was John Reed. He was down there actually covering the Pancho Villa Revolution for the New York Telegram of the World, one of those papers. And so there are some historical people that I left in, but they complimented the tale. Mm-hmm. But I think it gives a reader a little bit of framework.
Sure.
Occasionally throw in a historical person, as long as you keep them in character.
Right. Well, for more inventions of the kind of writing that we're so used to with wonderful book like Forrest Gump, the name of the book is El Paso. My guest is Winston Groom, the author of 21 books, including, of course, the American classic Forrest Gump. And Winston joined me today from Point Clear, Alabama. Alabama's a great place. Thank you so much for joining us, Winston.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.